For the last few years, Disney has been turning its beloved animated films into live-action revamps, a project that continues apace with The Lion King.
But this revamp isn't live-action, even though it looks like it is. The digital animation is ridiculously advanced, bringing Simba, Mufasa, Scar, Nala, Timon, and Pumbaa to eerie, ultra-realistic life.
It looks great, and the voice cast is full of ringers. Chiwetel Ejiofor, John Oliver, Billy Eichner, Seth Rogen, Donald Glover, and a brash up-and-comer named Beyoncé. Can you feel the
love tonight? But do the changes they make to the story and to the songs we have thoughts improve on the original? I'm Stephen Thompson. That's what we're going to hash out on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
I'm Glenn Weldon. Here with us in the studio is writer Katie Presley. Hey, Katie.
Howdy.
And joining us from the New York Times is Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Hello, hello.
All right. Now, I am happy, and I think it's very refreshing. We can spoil the hell out of this thing because this
is... since 1994.
Exactly. This is largely a beat-by-beat retread of a story that has seeped into the cultural consciousness. So, on the off chance that you don't know The Lion King because you spent the last 25 years off the grid and this podcast is reaching you through your fillings and your molars somehow, here's the story. Hamlet with fur. There's the story. We're done. So, Aisha, I'm going to start with you. What'd you make of the new Lion King?
Well, when the trailer first came out a few months ago, I tweeted something to the effect of that the trailer looked like they had basically taken the audio of the original film and dubbed it over like a really uncanny episode of Planet Earth.
Right.
And I feel like the remake is exactly the same. The opening, Circle of Life, which what I remember seeing as a child and being just stunned and in awe of it. And I think I've seen it enough times to know that I'm like 99% sure that this remake is basically a shot for shot mm-hmm. of Circle of Life. Even like down to the timing of the way in which these things, all the shots happen and everything look exactly the same. And so I came away with this basically meh. Like, that was my reaction overall. When compared to something like Aladdin, the remake that came out 2 months ago, this was far and away much better. But I found the singing to be just okay, especially Donald Glover. I was kind of disappointed. I thought he would be, like, a little bit stronger in the singing department. And I also just found it weird to watch these very, very realistic characters in dramatic moments and have no real facial expression. What was lost in the creation of this very realistic animation is actual expressiveness. In
right.
the original, you know, the faces, the eyes would move. When Mufasa dies, you can see Simba's face just like his eyes well up. And here, you know, the voice acting, I think, is there. So the actor who plays young Simba, who's voiced by J.D. McCrary, he, I think, does a really great job in the acting department. And, like, there's a moment where his voice cracks. And, like, I wanted to feel that. I wanted to be, like, I wanted to feel as though Mufasa dying was, like, the first time I'd seen it.
Right.
And I didn't, because while that was happening, Simba's face was just, like, dead.
Cat face.
Yeah. So overall, my feeling about this was that it just, like, feels hollow. You know, Timon and Pumbaa, I think, were by far the best parts just because they were funny and there were a lot of ad-libs that weren't in the original film.
Right, absolutely. Katie, what'd you think?
I agree with Aisha, and I would also add my big takeaway was viscera because of the realism and also the emotion, which I am sure we all have thoughts on. There is a lot more anger in this film, a lot more darkness, like visceral kind of the organ meat equivalent of emotions shows up a lot in this.
The umami.
Exactly. And also, there's a lot more individual cat hairs blowing in the breeze. You know, wet cat tech has, like, come a long way. And also, that visceralness, you go into this movie thinking, I'm going to watch a lion get trampled to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, my hands were sweaty when Simba was born, because I knew it was going to be like watching a large, real cat get mauled. I can't imagine giving this movie to a child the way that you gave me in 1994 Lion King. And like, here you go, kiddo. Here is exactly what it probably looks like to drop a large cat from a great height. And then this like adorable little kitten, which Disney has taught us to anthropomorphize.
Right.
Is going to go touch its dead bod. You know, like, that was, it was hard for me. It, like, This movie is earthy.
Earthy. Steven, follow Earthy.
he's been trying since the day we met.
You know, I have had a complicated relationship with The Lion King, dating back to its release in June of 1994. A little bit of personal background. My own father died on May 23rd, 1994. Oh, The Lion King came out on June 15th, 1994. I had strong feelings about it.
Yeah, this is Daddy Issues the movie.
Which have never subsided. Mm-hmm. So every time I see the original Lion King, I have the exact same emotionally visceral response. And even seeing this remake with all the flaws that you guys have very accurately laid out, I still react to the story and this particular telling of that Hamlet story in a very... I get pulled into it very, very quickly and very, very effectively. So I generally, on balance, think this was an effective kind of different way of presenting this story with all those same flaws that you've mentioned. The photorealism does not always suit this story. Mostly I come back to the same issues that I've had with the other live action slash quote unquote live action Disney remakes, which is why. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily answer the question of why. And then I think there are nitpicks all the way through. There are voice acting choices that I like and voice acting choices that I dislike. And Glenn, you and I are going to talk about Scar.
Yes, we are.
We're all going to talk about Scar.
As long as I have known Glenn, to have a strong connection to the original Jeremy Irons voiced Scar.
Uh-huh.
This particular Scar, as voiced by Chiwetel Ejiofor, I didn't quite understand the choice to make this particular Scar so joyless and rageful.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a little bit of tape. So let's go back. Let's get a taste, a sousson of the original. Of the original Scar as Jeremy Irons. Be prepared for sensational news. A shiny new era is tiptoeing nearer. And where do we... Now, what you get in that, in just the voice, even though he's not a singer, right? He is talk singing through much of that song. Mm-hmm. What you get is characterization, pure characterization. You can hear the extended pinky. You can hear the mustache twirling. It's all there in the voice. Yep. Here is Chiwetel Ejiofor as Scar.
My vision is clear and wide-ranging, and even encompasses you.
There we go. That's it.
Thud. You can actually hear a thud.
They've changed it from this kind of syncopated, almost calypso number two, mm-hmm. a dirge. Basically. Yeah. And they did it purposefully because they have to encompass a new subplot in this film, which is that the hyenas are no longer just Scar's stooges. They're this separate culture that we get a sort of a little hint that they've been pushed down on mm-hmm. by the lions. And so the entire song is different. It's more a plea to help him as opposed to spitting invective, which is what Scar should be doing.
I walked out of the theater and I turned to Steven and I said, there's no slink in this Scar.
There's no slink in this Scar.
And the original Scar was part of that slinkiness was that he's kind of runty, you know? Compared to Mufasa, he's the skinny brother who would never be king. His mane's a different color and it's kind of... And this Scar is big and mean and
mad. Looks like Mufasa.
He looks like Mufasa minus one bad fight. The old Scar, his slinkiness was that he brought in the other outcasts and didn't have to really lift a finger. It was just like, hey, do this revolution for me, please. I'll mastermind it and you all just be the henchmen. Mm-hmm. And this Scar was... absolutely murderous. His eyes didn't gleam with it because they all had dead eyes.
That's true.
You know, his being, he would have slit his throat while he slept, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this film is at war with itself, and I couldn't figure out why for the longest time. It took me half the film to figure it out. But I think conventionally animated musicals work so well because both the medium of animation and the genre of musical are really about expression, mm-hmm. emotion, something mm-hmm. that kind of bursts forth, right, because regular life can't contain it. So in animation, laws of physics, laws of anatomy, laws of time can get contorted by intense emotion. And just as that, and in musicals, everything stops dead so a dream ballet can happen or somebody can just belt out a show tune because it's the only way they can express that emotion. And when you have a conventionally animated musical, they're working in concert because we don't realize it, but those little moments, because they have become so conventional, are a little moments of like absurdism, of something stylized, of something surreal. This film's insistence on ultra-realism is basically just quashing the emotion, quashing the imagination, quashing the expressiveness, the fun of the original, as we've all said. You see it in that moment in Can You Feel the Love Tonight, which we quoted at the top, where Nala and Simba are looking across a pond at each other, and the music is telling me they're falling in love.
Feelings, and, feelings, feelings.
And their faces are telling me...
Cats.
Cats. Based, not Cats the Musical,
nope.
Unfortunately.
This might be a preview of Cats. Who knows?
That's exactly right. That's what we're going to get. It's Blue Planet is happening, right, Aisha?
Yeah, I mean, this is also especially true in another number that's supposed to be very expressive, I Just Can't Wait to Be King, where in the original cartoon version, the animals were dancing and moving and like
Busby
Simba
Berkeley.
And Nala were like, yeah, it's very Busby Berkeley. They were Simba and Nala were perched on top of like some ostriches or something. Like all of these fun things were happening and it was super colorful. And here it's just like, because they're supposed to be realistic, they kind of just sway along and the song is like bumping and it's just as lively, but it's like it feels slowed down. And this has happened even in the this also has happened a lot in the other live action musicals they've done, I think in part because it's so hard to transfer. I mean, those were live action remakes, like the Aladdin remake, where Prince Ali felt just like plodding and slow.
Soul deadening.
So dead. And it's happening again here. And it's just so disappointing to see that happen.
Well, let's talk about the new music, can we? This is the original songs by Elton John and Tim Rice used/appropriated African rhythms and melodies and instruments and made them Broadway. Here... this one lets Beyoncé be Beyoncé to a certain extent. We got a lot more melisma than we get on a normal Disney soundtrack. They let Glover riff a bit, but I agree with you, Aisha. He was kind of subdued here. What do you guys think?
I was not crazy about Spirit. The Beyoncé pitched Oscar pitch. So, like, let me put some silver lining on this cloud. The music by Lebo M, the South African composer whose voice is the first voice you hear and who was billed on this one as African music consultant. Whatever you make of that. He is the voice of the Lion King, and to not have gotten him back and to not have had his fingerprints all over this would have been, I would have burnt the theater to the ground. So there are some really fabulous incorporations of Southern Cape music feelings that I loved, but the contemporary music that was brought in did not move me really in the slightest.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I thought that Spirit song just kind of landed with a plop. For one thing, all I remember from it was just like, Spirit! And that's kind of it.
Well, here's the thing, is that Spirit is like the listen of Lion King. And by listen, I mean the Dreamgirls song that they added for Beyoncé in 2006, which was not a good song. But it was clearly an Oscar play. And this one, I think, also... this is where it felt like a mistake again, an attempt to put more Beyoncé in the movie than was required. It just felt like a very modern, out of place, like anachronistic song to be in this movie, even though obviously all of the songs are not a direct match to Africa. But like, it just felt weird.
Well, and we should note, we haven't heard it as of this taping, but Beyoncé is doing an album, a Lion King-inspired album of songs in which she's collaborating with a lot of different people to make an album kind of about the Lion King.
Let's talk a little about Beyoncé, shall we? Do you guys remember all the subtle nuance she brought to her performance in the Telephone video? She is bringing some of that. I got
bad
a lot of
girl Gaga.
I got a lot of you've been a bad girl Gaga in, from this particular performance. And when Nala looks so much like all the other female lions,
you need
some individuality. You need some Beyoncé in this thing.
Yeah, this is why I think Beyoncé has never been a great actor, is the vulnerability required. This is a performer who has shown us again and again and again that she will take the thing 85,000 times to get it perfect. And when you're acting, I think some of the best performances come through when you let go. She's trying to nail a performance that asks her to open up. She read to me as very closed off. In voice acting, I think you really just gotta stay open.
You know who didn't stay open and yet was great was Billy Eichner, the MVP of this particular. He plays Timon. First of all, he's got pipes, which shouldn't come as a surprise because he was a, you know, a theater major. Mm. But his Timon is basically Timon on the street. He's basically, he comes off slightly pissed. Timon on the street. Can we hear a little bit of just the very beginning of Hakuna Matata?
Great.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase.
It just sounds sarcastic.
It's very Stimpy.
It's very. Yeah, I don't know if they were ad libs or not. They probably weren't. But I mean, there's something about that where they give that performer and Seth Rogen, who plays Pumbaa, a little bit more room to do stuff. And that's where the film starts to succeed. That's where the film starts to come to life.
Yeah, I found that pairing to be a little uneven for me because while I loved the Billy Eichner performance, I was not buying into Seth Rogen as the Warthog for whatever reason, in part because if you go back and listen to that Ernie Sabella performance as the original Pumbaa in the 1994 version, that Ernie Sabella performance is so magnificent. And here, Seth Rogen just kind of sounds like Seth Rogen.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the voices we haven't talked about yet is the return after 25 years of James Earl Jones as Mufasa, who still sounds great.
Mm, dad to us all.
That's exactly. So in the original, the only people of color in the voice cast were Mufasa and young Nala and Rafiki and the hyenas. This film corrects that to a certain extent. No Matthew Broderick in this one. And someone pointed out on Twitter that this is a blacker Lion King. Does that mean anything to you?
That makes me think of a couple of things. One is The Lion King is a distinctly African story. I wish there had been more African actors in it. Two actors that I want to specifically point out are Florence Kasumba, who played the hyena queen, and John Canney, who is from the Eastern Cape in South Africa, and he plays Rafiki, and he brings the Isikosa. He's the one speaking in various Bantu languages. Those performances are so important to me, and I think important to have in a Disney movie, but I wanted there to be more. So, like, yes, give me a blacker Lion King. Now give me a more African Lion King. Like, more.
One of the things that made the original a little problematic was the fact that there were black voices. It's just that one of those black voices was a singing voice for Jonathan Taylor Thomas's character. So Jason Weaver, who was a pretty well-known, he was one of those like child black actors who was in everything in the 90s, but he played the singing voice of Simba. So you could go into a lot of, there's a lot of things to pull from that.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, minstrelsy and stealing of voices, whatever. But I agree that I see this as a very black film, even the original as a very black film in many ways. And I think that taking it a step further in the way that the Broadway version did, in which most of the Broadway cast in the original, and I think since has been mostly actors of color playing those roles, I think is really important. Now, do I still think that like this didn't need to be made? Yeah. I mean, I'm glad they cast mostly black people in these roles, but like, again, this was such a hollow exercise. And if I had kids, I don't think I would want to take them to see this, especially if they were under the age of like 5, because this movie is actually kind of terrifying in a way that the original was not.
All right, so tell us what you think about The Lion King. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury items. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices. From your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at therealreal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Jump, a new MailChimp original podcast. Listen as host Shirley Manson sits down with some of the most influential musicians of the last two decades, including Big Boi, Perfume Genius, and Courtney Love, to discuss the song that represents their artistic moments of truth and the impact that song had on both their careers and their lives. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week. And every week, what is making us happy this week? Steven, what's making you happy this week?
So a piece of service journalism about a piece of service journalism that everybody except me already knows about, Wirecutter.
Ah.
I did not know this was a thing until Katie told me about it like 4 days ago, where the New York Times acquired this gadget review site, basically a Consumer Reports style site, and just tells you what to buy. I had absolutely no, I've known about Consumer Reports since somehow before I was born, but Wirecutter understands that I don't want to actually read about the things I want to buy. I just want to be told, buy this dummy, click here, and then it just shows up. And it is absolutely uncanny how much easier this site has already made my drab gray life. Tell me what to buy, wirecutter.com. Thank you for existing.
Oof,
I did not know this existed.
Yeah, Stephen Thompson going full dad. Full dad on us.
So full dad.
Oh, my God. Katie, what is making you happy this week?
A couple of months ago, I discovered a book. And when you are a book person, the discovery of a book that no one else around you has read is like a drug. And you get bragging rights forever. So I discovered this little book called Maud's Line by Margaret Verbal. I breezed into work that day and I was like, gather around, y'all. I read a great book. You've never heard of it. Yada, yada, yada. It was shortlisted for the Pulitzer. Nobody discovered anything. But the fact remains, I read an amazing book. So it takes place in Eastern Oklahoma in 1928. It follows an 18-year-old young woman named Maud Nail. She's part Cherokee, and she lives on a Cherokee allotment, which is what Maud's line mean. It means the lines of her family's allotment. It's a slow-moving book. It's slight, but so richly drawn that it's completely immersive every step of the way. If you are from the middle part of the country or a Westerner in any way, I think the way that this book describes wide open space and people living close to the land will hit you right in the sternum as it did me. It's earthy, it's sensual, sometimes it's downright sexy. And then there's this beautiful little love story in the middle of it, which is very Brooklynian, like the movie Brooklyn, where her choice basically boils down to boy from around the way versus boy who means a new life. So I cannot recommend it highly enough. Maud's Line, the author is Margaret Verbal.
Oh, I have just written that down. Thank you so much, Katie. Aisha Harris, what's making you happy this week?
Just a couple days ago, I actually stumbled upon a movie that is, it's a little well known, maybe not as well known as other movies, but it's called Mother. And this is not Mother with an exclamation point from a few years ago, that perplexing, overwrought Darren Aronofsky movie starring Jennifer Lawrence, but rather Mother, directed by Albert Brooks from 1996. I think it resurfaced briefly a couple years ago, right after Debbie Reynolds died, as a movie that you should definitely check out. And I did not check it out then, but I'm glad I stumbled upon it now. Essentially, Debbie Reynolds plays Albert Brooks's mother. And Albert Brooks is this like successful science fiction writer who is just gone through his second divorce. And he's trying to figure out, like, why do I have so much bad luck with women? Why don't they understand me? And so he decides it must be my mother. And even though this sounds like a kind of, you know, potentially misogynistic exploration of mommy issues through Albert Brooks, the well-known neurotic, he loves to play those characters. It actually turns out to be very lovely, smart, intuitive. Brooks co-wrote the movie with Monica Johnson, so there is a female perspective in there, and I think that that really lends itself especially to the last part of the film and sort of a big reveal that happens later on. But I love their dynamic. I love Debbie Reynolds. She's just so, like, if you loved her in Singing in the Rain, it's like obviously a much older, more mature version of her, but like there's still that sort of bubbling crackliness there. So I highly recommend Mother. It is streaming. I watched it on the Criterion Channel. I think it's going to be there until the end of the month. So you should definitely check it out if you can.
Thank you, Aisha. That is a great pick. I mentioned the HBO BBC series Years and Years in the newsletter a few weeks back. After seeing only one episode, I've now seen two. I'm going through it slowly because it is not the kind of show you can binge. It's a little intense. It's about a large British family that gets caught up in the slow, steady dissolution of society. And it starts in the present day, and then everything just sort of smears forward in time just by a few years at a time with a very grounded and not entirely optimistic view of where we're headed. But everything that's happening in those few years ahead are based on what's happening now. As climate change, as institutions collapse, as humanity just keeps getting dumber and dumber, this family is clinging together. It is chilling the number of times somebody on screen says, no, it'll be all right. No, we'll be fine. because it won't. What's making me happy is the work Russell Davies is doing with characterization. There's a moment in the second episode where the family individually learns something upsetting about one of the sisters. And then we see the various brothers and sisters calling her and expressing their concerns, but they do it in very different ways, which echo their characters, which is just smart. This is how you do characterization. This person would say that. This person would react this way. I'm only two episodes in, and I'm already caught up like that. So it's a really nice moment of human connection in a show about people struggling to connect as the world falls apart. And that's what's making me happy.
Sign me up.
Yes.
All right. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Katie at Love Is Maroon. You can follow Aisha at Crafting My Style. You can follow producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In is providing the music you could feasibly be bobbing your head to right now if that's a thing you choose to do. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all next week.
We spend millions of hours and billions of dollars on video games, but can consoles still compete with the next level of streaming and subscriber services? I'm Joshua Johnson. Subscribe to 1A on NPR as we consider the future of gaming.